Friends are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. And now I would like to take our microphones down to Bowling Green and to welcome a very well-known public figure, friend Arthur Piccolo, who is chairman of Bowling Green Association and co-founder of the Lower Manhattan Historical Association. And Arthur, you're very lucky indeed that that this year in particular, it seems like the weather is going to be cooperating and that your efforts and your work have, you know, through the years have really helped focus on where July 4th, our independence celebration in the United States, actually started, where it began. You're very welcome to the program.
Well, I'm most lucky, Adrian, to have found Bowling Green. I mean, what a perfect name for the place where New York City was founded, Bowling Green. And as you and I both know, the rich Irish history down here, who I am a major proponent for, because, you know, there are these great stories associating the Irish community with Bowling Green specifically, and, you know, three that I always talk about, and they relate very well to the July 4th experience. First of all, Hercules Mulligan, the great Hercules Mulligan, who came here as a young boy from Ireland in the mid to early 1700s, almost immediately took up the cause of independence long before, quite a while before 1776, became a leading member of the Sons of Liberty down here, was instrumental in one of the great little-known historical moments in American history, which did not happen on July 4th, but on July 9th. Which, in fact, was the day that word, in July 4th, 1776, was just a normal day of pre-revolution insurrection in New York City, because New Yorkers had no way of knowing that on July 4th, 1776, finally a Declaration of Independence was signed in Philadelphia. But they found out on July 9th when a rider arrived with an original copy of the Declaration and put it into the hands of George Washington, who was here, and he ordered that it be read in numerous locations up and down Broadway, all the way up to the Commons, which is now City Hall. But Hercules Mulligan and other leading patriots decided to celebrate, if that's the proper word for it, by marching down to Bowling Green, where the hated statue of the King of England, George III, on a horse, was featured by the British in the middle of Bowling Green Park, where those who are familiar with Bowling Green, where the fountain is today. And what they did is they broke into the park, which had been, the British had put up a fence to protect their statue from vandalism by the colonists. And Hercules Mulligan led a group of patriots into the park, and they destroyed the statue on the evening of July 9th, 1776. And although there had been any number of skirmishes before that, before the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the fact is what I call the first official act of insurrection once independence was declared was that very act led by Hercules Mulligan to go into the park and destroy this British property as a blatant sign of liberty. And Hercules Mulligan, who was also best friends with the great Alexander Hamilton, going back even earlier, Alexander Hamilton arrived here, another immigrant from Nevis. He arrived in New York City, which was Lower Manhattan, and he knew nobody. But quickly he made contact with Hercules Mulligan, and Hercules Mulligan's family took him in. He lived for quite a while when he first came here as a young teenager with Hercules Mulligan, and they became best friends. And Hercules Mulligan went on to become a tailor who was favored by the British officers who were stationed here prior to 1776, and then again after 1776. And it turned out Hercules Mulligan, they were coming into his tailor shop. you know, which they all wanted their uniforms made by him, and they would talk freely. And he was, in effect, spying for the Americans, and very influential information that he was passing on to Hamilton and Washington, to others. The famous story is that when the Revolutionary War came to a successful conclusion, the final day, literally, the day that independence became real was on November 25th, 1783, when George Washington, after the Battle of Yorktown, came into New York to witness the last British troops leaving American soil and the last British flag being taken down right here at Bowling Green. But Alexander Hamilton took George Washington to have breakfast with Hercules Mulligan, because there were those who thought that because he was the tailor to the British, that maybe he was really a British sympathizer. And George Washington went to have breakfast with Alexander Hamilton and Hercules Mulligan at his home to prove that Hercules Mulligan was a great patriot. And that's just a wonderful story of the Irish tradition down here. And that's one of three stories, if I have the time, I'd like to relate. Going back further, to me, the most important of all, was March 17, 1762. That was the origin of the St. Patrick's Day parade anywhere in the world. That was the day that conscripted Irish soldiers who had been forced into the British Army by the British and were sent here to New York City, and they had the audacity, they had the good sense to basically on patron saint day of St. Patrick on March 17, 1776, decided to promenade, to parade up and down Lower Broadway. They were stationed here at Bowling Green at the fort, which was then called Fort George, but they had the audacity to basically show their Irish pride and defy the British Army and march up and down Broadway on that day in honor of St. Patrick's Day, along with local colonists, Irish colonists who were increasingly in numbers here, and they successfully defied. We think of the parade as a positive celebration of Irish pride, which it is, but it was really a protest march at the same time. It was, in effect, the first time in the American colonies that there was a public display of antagonism towards the British. So in a certain way, on a certain symbolic way, the American Revolution had its first act of defiance against the British right here in New York City as the very first St. Patrick's Day parade. It wasn't called that officially then, but it's absolutely, yeah. And as you know better than I, the Irish community fully embraces the fact that the origin of the St. Patrick's Day dates from March 17, 1762, right here at Bowling Green. So that's another very proud element down here that I'm so happy about. The third one I want to mention is the immortal Irishman, Francis Patrick Marr, who basically came back from the Battle of Bull Run in 1861, of the Civil War. And he and his troops, even though the Americans had not won that battle, he came back as the new leader of the Fighting 69th, all right, the Irish Brigade. And he began, when they got off the ships, when they came back, he led the troops on a march up Broadway from Bowling Green, leading him as the new leader of the Fighting 69th, with thousands of Irish men, women, and children cheering him. And that march began right here at Bowling Green. And there's a very famous painting, which is at the New York Historical Society, which shows him leading this march. And the artist depicted him right at Bowling Green, sitting on his horse, leading that march. And so there's that part of history. It also, if I may note, you know, the largest contingent of those Americans who fought in the American Revolutionary War, the largest were Irish. They were Irish Americans. There were more Irish Americans among the American soldiers in the Continental Army than any other single group. And quite a few of them died in battle, others on the British prison ships in New York Harbor. So the Irish involvement with the American Revolution is huge.
Arthur Piccolo, let me ask you about Federal Hall. for those who visit downtown Manhattan and the Wall Street area and the historic, the numerous historic sites down there, Federal Hall,
yes,
somehow becomes one more, and yet the Federal Hall, bring us back to the establishment of Federal Hall and its significance.
Well, yes, the establishment of Federal Hall, and what I'll also call the tragedy of Federal Hall as one aspect of that. Federal Hall today, what we all know as Federal Hall, is a monument that sits on the very site where the American government first was established, under the U.S. Constitution in March of 1789. It was the first capital of the United States. It's where on April 30th that George Washington became the first president of the United States on the balcony of what was then Federal Hall on April 30th, 1789. And another critically important event in American history was September 11th. Yes, September 11th, 1789, where at that same site, Alexander Hamilton was nominated, approved, and became the first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, and as I call him, the savior of the nation with his financial plan to fund the nation. Yeah. And the first Senate, the first House of Representatives, the president even had an office in those days in what was then Federal Hall. What happened, unfortunately, I mean, this to me, as and I think anyone would agree, it was an historic site as Independence Hall in Philadelphia. The fact is, if that original building existed today, it would absolutely be as much of a focus of attention to the exact spot where George Washington became president, the exact rooms where the U.S. Senate first met, where the U.S. House met, where the Bill of Rights was passed and approved. Turns out, in New York City style, that after the federal government left for Philadelphia and then ultimately Washington, D.C., what happened was it became New York City Hall once again, which it had been before. By the way, architecturally, it was considered the finest building in the United States. It was that superb a building, the original building. But the so-called city fathers decided they wanted a new city hall. That wasn't good enough for them. Mm-hmm. And what they, in fact, built was what is today's city hall, up at City Hall now, which was then the Commons. But they were worried about being criticized for spending all that money when they had a perfectly good city hall, which was Federal Hall. And so when they sold the building, and in the sale, it was required that the new owners destroy the building so that they didn't have to worry about being criticized that they had moved to a new building, and people keep saying to them, citizens, why didn't you stay in the old building? Because the old building no longer existed. I think that's the greatest architectural tragedy in the history of our country, and I, so every day, every time it comes up, I wish that original building still existed.
How did it differ architecturally?
Well, it was totally different. It was the building there now is sort of a monumental structure. You know, it looks monumental. This was an actual building, and LaFont, who designed Washington, D.C. For the government. He was a famous mm-hmm. architect of his day. What he came in and he took the original building, which from earlier, and he totally renovated it for the new government. And it was widely considered the most beautiful and dynamic building anywhere in the yeah. United States in those early days. It was a beautiful building. I mean, there were certainly, you'll see representations. There's a model of it in Federal Hall today. But it was a magnificently constructed. It had a central dome also where the light filtered in. There was ornate chambers for the Senate and the House. The Supreme Court also met there. I mean, the whole government. So today, if it existed, you know, we and children would walk in there and they would be seeing the exact place where all those famous American founders, you know, Washington, yes. Hamilton, Jefferson, Adams, that's where they were all doing business as the first government of the United States. And it's just a tragedy. I mean, the idea that Independence Hall not existing would be, you know, people wouldn't yeah. even consider, how could that not be? But interestingly enough, a building of equal significance in our history was torn down.
Yeah. Now, what is not torn down, of course, is the spot and
yes.
the significance
yes.
of the spot.
Yes. And in effect, the building that was built there, and now it was sort of, it's like a monument. I mean, it's good in that it's architecturally, it's sort of like it's a monument built on the site. I mean, it wasn't just tossed out and became an office building or anything
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm. And we know what can happen, you know, throughout, well, not just throughout New York, but throughout the United States, in particular, when in the dark of night decisions are made through zoning changes to take
mm-hmm.
very historical parts, you know, which without doubt should be preserved, and you know, just you know, get the ball, knock it down, and put up something more commercially useful. Can you tell us though, just at that time, where did, for instance, Hamilton, Mulligan, where did they live? Were they occupants of the Bowling Green area there?
Well, yeah, well, the whole city at that point was still south of basically where City Hall is today. Mulligan was on Pearl Street. Hamilton, at the point where the government being established under the Constitution, had his own home on Wall Street, only a few yards away from Federal Hall. You know, and both Mulligan and Hamilton, once they came to the United States, spent their entire lives living here in Lower Manhattan. Hamilton traveling a bit as a member of the Continental Army and as Washington's aide-de-camp,
yeah.
but they always live their lives here. Unfortunately, Mulligan, Hercules Mulligan, is his remains are somewhere in Trinity Churchyard, but the actual site was lost. We obviously have Hamilton. We know exactly where Hamilton
yes.
Is buried within the graveyard. But Mulligan is somewhere not far away, but the exact site can no longer be identified. So they both rest eternally, not far from each other, in Trinity Churchyard right now.
Was Hamilton considered somewhat of a rebel, a cranky upstart? Was that
well, the main slam against him by the other leaders was that he was an immigrant. You know, I don't know if people concentrate on the fact that every single one of the other founders were born here. All right. Even though their family
right.
came, almost all of them from the British Isles, the fact is they were all born here. And you know, his number one critic, Thomas Jefferson, I mean, he always used to hit him with that, you know, behind his back. They always talk about the bastard immigrant. You know, he was born in poverty on the little island Nevis in the Caribbean. His father left the family. His mother died shortly after that. And he was orphaned, him and his young brother, and they had to basically make it on their own. And he had so much talent that some of the merchants on St. Croix immediately noticed, and he was, as a very young teenager, 12 and 13 years old, was managing part of the operation of this company in St. Croix, this retailer and importer, and that's how he got this idea to come to America. But I refer to him as America's greatest immigrant, and I think that's a title that's hard to dispute, and because of the impact he had once he came here and throughout his life. But the immigrant status, and by the way, we, you know, talking about him and talking about Federal Hall, something very, very nice that has happened at Federal Hall, and you know well, last July, you know, July 3rd, just before Independence Day, when the Lower Manhattan Historical Society, now officially called the Lower Manhattan Historical Association, for the first time gave out the Alexander Hamilton Immigrant Achievement Award, and we were very proud that you were one of those first recipients, and I remember that memorable speech you made right inside Federal Hall. So this, you know, the Alexander Hamilton Immigrant Achievement Award, specifically to honor immigrants who came to America and made a great mark here, as Hamilton did, and that took place right in the very same location where Alexander Hamilton became the first Secretary of the Treasury.
I treasure, and I really mean it, I treasure that award very much. And indeed, and each year there are, well, each year, it only started last year, but there are four
yes.
immigrants who received the Alexander Hamilton Award. I know that an Irish immigrant, actually from a neighboring county of my own, and I'm from Mayo. Next county is Sligo, and restaurateur Jimmy Neary,
yes,
is whose restaurant is on 57th Street, born in Ireland, and he is one of four immigrants being honored this year.
Yes, that's happening on Sunday,
yeah,
on July 2nd this year. It's at 11 a.m. Anyone who's listening in the New York area, it's open to anyone who wants to come and see Mr. Neary and hear him receive the award, and I'm sure give a great speech, as you did last year. This is at 11 a.m. tomorrow, Sunday, yeah, at Federal Hall. Everyone is welcome, and as a matter of fact, after the awards are given this year, somewhat different than our Irish and American Independence Parade, our great parade last year from the Irish Hunger Memorial to Bowling Green. This time, the award is, and this parade, pre-July 4th parade, are being combined. So after these ceremonies, which will last about an hour from 11 to 12, there's going to be a parade through the streets of Lower Manhattan from Federal Hall, led by the award winners, including Mr. Neary. And again, people are encouraged to come and participate in that, and if people also have Irish flags to bring with them, so much the better, and to join in the parade and the festivities tomorrow.
You also have, of course, a very significant, well-known, and influential immigrant in Peter Koo, who is city councilor from Flushing. He was born in Hong Kong.
Yes, yes, yes.
And again, you have Guillermo Linares, who headed New York State Higher Education Student Loan Agency,
yep,
from Washington Heights. He's you have Jimmy Neary, and then you have Chikanka Watch, a radio personality. And
yes, that was an interesting choice.
Yeah, Salvation Army pastor who was born in Zimbabwe. Let me ask you about the a little bit more, perhaps, about the Lower Manhattan Historical Association, and you as co-founder. What was the impetus?
Well, the motivation was the fact that I want to give Jim Kaplan, who is the president, full credit for this. He simply tried to bring a bunch of us together who were involved in Lower Manhattan a number of years ago. He wanted to do something on July 4th, which had been done every year years ago in Lower Manhattan, but now was only being done on major anniversaries like the 200th, the bicentennial, and things like that. And he, you know, tried to convince us, and I said to him, you know, well, rather than just do this in an impromptu way, let's form a group, which originally was the Lower Manhattan Historical Society, and let's do events year-round with particular emphasis on July 4th. And you know, with the two of us started it, and then we got some others, and we put together a board, and, you know, it's become quite active, and I'm sure will remain active. I, for myself, want to see us starting to plan right now for what will become the next great American Independence celebration, which of course will be, although it's 9 years away, 2026, which will be the 250th anniversary, which probably will in its level of celebration will probably go beyond the 200th anniversary. And I want to see us in Lower Manhattan have an absolutely central role. In fact, Philadelphia, once again, not to surprise, is ahead. They're already deep into planning for the 250th anniversary and for that magnificent celebration in July of 2026. So I'm hoping that we will, you know, basically take a major lead and begin doing some serious planning very soon.
Now, the Independence Day March also taking place tomorrow, celebrating the bicentennial of the Erie Canal.
Yes.
You know, again, so many amazing historic When we speak of America and speak of centenaries and bicentennials, that may not sound like a big deal to listeners, you know, to our program throughout the world, but we have to figure we're talking about a very young continent, a very young America. In fact, when you celebrate a bicentennial, that is indeed wildly significant. And as an historian, when you look at the last couple of 100 years, or you know, coming up to 250 years, what is what role does New York play in terms of the history of the United States, and specifically Lower Manhattan, where a lot of the revolutionary activity and the planning of the United States took place? How do you think that's going to be figured historically?
Well, I mean, it's figured very much historically as sort of like the financial and economic engine. Mm-hmm. I mean, the prominence of New York City and Lower Manhattan, which is still great today, it was even more overwhelming in the formative years. I mean, there was, shortly after the American Revolution, getting into the early 1800s, beginning in the early 1800s, and with, the, of course, the establishment of the New York Stock Exchange and major banks down here, I mean, New York City was always the financial capital. It was always where the economic engine existed, and that existed throughout the 1800s into the 1900s. And, you know, now in today's day, with electronic trading and with a global economic system, the physical presence doesn't have the same level of importance. But symbolically, you know, Wall Street is still Wall Street. I mean, yeah. Wall Street as a street, as a symbol, I mean, I think even hundreds of years from now, you know, there will still, you know, we use Wall Street generically now as sort of like as talking about, you know, the financial system, but Wall Street also, of course, very much is a very physical place, and it remains that way. And although there is still trading at the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, it's symbolic in many ways, but all the firms still come and ring the bell, and I think that situation will always remain. So I think the symbolism is there, and of course, New York City keeps expanding like all the other great cities, and of course, it's far and away the largest city in the United States, although there are now other cities around the world that are far larger. But, you know, New York City, you can't conceive of within any time period within the United States that any city is going to overtake New York City as the economic, as the cultural, as the artistic,
revolutionary, you could throw in there. Yes, you could throw in revolutionary as well, and that's where it happened. Tomorrow, for those who are going down, I would like to let you know that the march, which we attended last year, one is very significant, and there is a great presence in the march. With Clinton, reenactor, will read excerpts from the 1815 New York Memorial to convince New Yorkers to support the construction of the Erie Canal, for instance. And you're going to have marching bands, Veteran Corps,
Corps of Artillery, New York State, the oldest military continuously existing in New York State. Yes, yes. They very colorful uniforms. They will be there, and there'll be other groups marching.
Richmond County Fife and Drum.
Yes, and what's so good about the Richmond County Fife and Drum is they led the parade last year. I hope this becomes a tradition. You know, that was a great parade last year. I don't think this year's is going to top it, although it's going to be worthwhile. I mean, that was a wonderful march from the Irish Hunger Memorial to Bowling Green and the raising of the Irish flag here. By the way, you know, you talk about bicentennials. There's also, of course, centennials, and last year we had, there was great celebrations in all of Manhattan of the Easter Sunday Rebellion, and I was so proud, and I hope other people were so proud of, that our huge Irish flag, which we fly at Bowling Green numerous times during the year, that it was carried over to Dublin, and it was flown over the Dublin GPO, the same Dublin GPO where the Irish flag was first flown back then on Easter Sunday in 1916. I also want to mention there was the key of that celebration last year in the United States was this incredible ceremony on the harbor, you know, at Battery Park.
Yeah.
I just thought that was, I still think personally, of the very many celebrations I thought that was so powerful, so wonderful. It was just absolutely memorable.
Well, I when we had many discussions around the time you were talking about getting a flag over to Ireland, flying it over.
You were involved with that very much.
I was involved with that. As a matter of fact, I was, I remember quite strongly saying that it's a lovely idea, Arthur Piccolo. It ain't going to happen. And, you know, if you think that can happen, I don't know. But listen, get your Grand Marshal, historian, our premier historian, Irish historian, Dr. Maureen Murphy, she's going over there, and I was hoping that you would, you know, have the great sense of confidence that we've shared, and you know, just tell Maureen that this was your idea, but you didn't. You picked up the phone. You said, "Adrian said." And my God, you know, well, we've made up sense, but I say that in jest, but it was a great, and it is a tremendous tribute in Bowling Green, and that would not have happened without you. And
well, I treasure that flag. We use it numerous times during the year. Yeah, two in particular, of course. It always flies during the period leading up to and on St. Patrick's Day, but also January 1st each year, you know, Annie Moore, the symbol of modern, I want to call it that, modern immigration, you know, the first immigrant to be processed through Ellis Island on January 1st, 1892, you know, as a modest tribute to her and all the immigrants that she represents. Every January 1st, we fly the flag. I give particular attention to the flag we have now, the Irish flag, because of the fact of that it, you know, the sacred nature that it has flown over the Dublin GPO. So I want to keep using that very same flag for years to come.
Congratulations. Sorry we can't be with you tomorrow. We'll be in Ireland, but we'll be sparing.
Well, your spirit will be with us.
Absolutely. Arthur Piccolo, chairman of the Bowling Green Association, co-founder of the Lower Manhattan Historical Association, and
maybe more importantly, founder of the Bowling Green Association, where the Irish experience in America began.
Did I not say that?
You did. I think you did, but I just wanted. I'd like to repeat it.
I know, and I was going to repeat it again. So now, for the last time. Most importantly, chairman of the Bowling Green Association.
What a perfect name, Bowling Green Association.
And the significance of the bowling and the bowler hat and oh my God. Okay, good luck to you.
Thank you, and happy July 4th to everyone.
All right, and give a cup of tea to Jimmy Neary there so he's not.
We'll do that, and I will send him your best regards.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.